This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And, of course, it's coming to the end of another month, which means it's time to assess what's been going on in the news for the month of September. And we're going to do that with our Editor's Roundtable. We do that once a month, and a regular, of course, is our own news director, Dave Thompson, who's always by our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
And I believe with you, John Hageman, Forum News Service.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm hunky darn dory today. It's Friday, after all. Mm-hmm. And by phone, Renee Jean, she's the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. Hello, Renee.
Hello.
Well, let's, gentlemen and lady, start talking about the circus, I think, that's taking place in Washington, D.C., where we've had a really tumultuous and perhaps historic Senate Judiciary Committee hearing over Brett Kavanaugh, the nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. The vote is over. He has been submitted to the full Senate, but my goodness, what a show it was.
Not only what a show, but, of course, the update is it's going to be at least a week.
Yeah.
Or it looks like it's going to be a week. Senator Flake from Arizona and some others have suggested that they have a week delay to allow for further investigation into some of the claims.
Yeah, there was, of course, over and over again, the Democrats on that committee were asking for an FBI investigation. And Jeff Flake, the Republican who's retiring, was obviously a linchpin in that decision.
Right. I haven't heard any updates. John, do you have some?
No, I mean, I think you summed it up pretty well. I mean, I think it's it looks like it's trending that way since they were, you know, obviously swing votes in this whole thing. I talked to Senator Heidi Heitkamp, who everyone's kind of watching to see where she's going to land on this morning, kind of before everything kind of changed again, which seems to be kind of how this whole thing is working. But she basically said she's undecided at this point and was still reviewing or dissecting yesterday's hearing, kind of the extraordinary hearing where he was, you know, defending himself from sexual assault allegations some three decades ago plus. Senator Heitkamp said, you know, Ford was believable, but she also wanted to weigh Kavanaugh's strong denial of that.
Well, Renee, is this playing at all in the Williston area?
Well, I haven't heard too much about it. I just did, however, from a roll call, the Senate has reached a deal to delay Kavanaugh's floor vote, which will include an FBI investigation. So,
well, that seems to be an important step forward of some sort at any rate. At least there will be, besides a background check, which I know the FBI has conducted on Brett Kavanaugh, there are specific allegations that will now be investigated, and perhaps the cloud will be lifted from the nomination, and perhaps not. I mean, look at Clarence Thomas many years after he ascended to the Supreme Court.
That's correct. Did the roll call story say that Speaker or the Leader McConnell has signed off on it?
Renee, did you see whether?
What?
Did you see whether
on roll call? Did it show that Speaker that the House Majority Leader,
the Senate Majority
Mitch
Leader?
McConnell, yeah. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has signed off on it?
Well, I just closed that, so.
How quickly the news passes.
Yeah, I just kind of closed that. But it said basically that they didn't have a choice but to go ahead and do that because they just didn't have the votes from the swing.
Gotcha.
There were a few Republicans who hadn't decided if they were going to support his nomination or not.
Lisa Murkowski and was Susan Collins in that undecided camp?
And Jeff Flake.
And Jeff Flake, of course, now.
Yeah, it seems to be, you know, the last count I saw was kind of it was like five senators basically who were undecided and are really, it's kind of in their hands. I mean, you know, Senator Hoeven came out yesterday and said, you know, he is standing by Kavanaugh. He doesn't think that he said that the facts available to them showed that, you know, Kavanaugh wasn't involved in this, didn't commit the sexual assaults. So he was, you know, standing by Kavanaugh. And, you know, we're down to these kind of five undecideds, high camp among them.
It seems that there are high stakes here, not just for Brett Kavanaugh, but for the parties. And one has to look at the Republican Party as more vulnerable here simply because of the issue of gender, the question of he says, she says, that kind of thing, and how that has played out in the on the national stage.
I tell you what, this is one of the more, if I may say, just intricate things, because there's a lot going on under the surface that we probably don't see.
Mm-hmm.
At least I'm hearing, you know, what I've been able to piece together. Just as a point, I did not get a chance to watch any of the hearing yesterday. I happened to be on the road, so I missed it.
Well, I had a chance to watch a good deal of it, and you know, both people, Dr. Ford and Kavanaugh, were very, very spirited in terms of their presentations. I think Kavanaugh, you know, was especially spirited. He had been accused, after all. But frankly, Dr. Ford gave a pretty compelling bit of testimony. So this is out there. Mm-hmm. It's on that national stage, and we do have a midterm election coming up, and this is being added to the storm clouds that have been developing for months now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, one thing that, I mean, Senator Heitkamp stressed today, and it sounds like she's supporting what Flake has called for, is she's, you know, wanted, you know, absent an FBI investigation, she you know, said basically this is the record that we have to weigh. We have to weigh what each of them has said, and what they've said is, you know, basically in conflict with each other. So it sounds like, you know, she's going to welcome that investigation. I'm not sure what it's going to bring, if it's going to bring any more certainty to it or not, but we'll see.
Well, there were a number of people who were implicated in the discussion yesterday who will undoubtedly now be interviewed, and perhaps that will shed additional light on this. But what a mess it has been. And what a strange thing to see happening on the Supreme Court. Now, I realize back, you know, 20-plus years ago we went through this with Clarence Thomas, but like I said, that's still over him. Now you have the potential of having two men on the U.S. Supreme Court with this kind of question in their background. It's a little unsettling. Well, let's move on to another issue of national and North Dakota importance, and that is the trade war that has now developed and is increasing between the United States and China, and there are other countries too, but the two main players, United States and China. Renee, are people in the northwest part of the state starting to pay attention to this, or is it, again, just flack in the background?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the farmers I've talked to kind of feel that this will all get worked out eventually and it'll all be well. But then again, some of the economists I've talked to, like Dr. Frayn Olson, he says, you know, they're wishful thinking. It's going to take a lot longer to fix this than a lot of them think. And I guess a concern has been whether, you know, especially the ones who have grown soybeans, there are special considerations when you're storing soybeans, temperature control and so forth to keep their quality. So he's concerned that a lot of people are going to take a short-term approach to it, and then they're not, you know, their crop's going to get, they're going to lose a lot of it.
Well, I've started to see advertisements for storage, for silos and things like that. So obviously there is at least one sector of the economy that will benefit from this.
And not only that, there was a news release from NDSU Extension saying, you know, maybe if you want to find a market, you know, use soybeans for cattle feed, which I thought was really interesting. That was an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Well, it could be, is that expensive cattle feed or very cheap cattle feed? And I think either way, it's a problem.
It gives it a use rather than just wasting it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, anything else about the trade war that we should get into, or just we're just watching it go by?
Well, the NAFTA discussion. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say the whole NAFTA discussion has been interesting about, you know, how Canada is being – how that's playing into this whole thing. It appears that there may be more of a close agreement with Mexico than there is with Canada.
Yes. That has been apparent, I think, for the last couple of weeks. And one wonders, is this going to be a bilateral agreement eventually? Or, you know, for North Dakota's sake, will Canada be returned to the fold?
Yeah. Well, I hear just like a lot of uncertainty from people I talk to about, you know, where all of this is going. And one story that I, you know, did this week, I was trying to kind of pinpoint, you know, because a lot of the talk has been around the farm economy, what this means for farmers. And I kind of tried to broaden that out to what does it mean for the statewide economy as a whole? Because, you know, state lawmakers have to start thinking about writing budgets soon. What is that going to mean? What is this, you know, potentially going to mean for tax collections, that kind of thing? And it seems like a kind of thing that's hard to pinpoint at this point. I mean, it's another thing that just gets thrown into the uncertainty is just not knowing how it's going to affect, you know, the overall economy. And then from that, what are sales tax collections going to look like, that kind of thing. So
yeah. It's a reminder that we are in many ways a two-commodity state. It's mm-hmm. either energy or ag. And the ag part has been under significant stress and continues to be. So that is an important part of the revenue picture for our state.
Right.
Let's talk about something else here now, and that is the measures that are going to be on the ballot come November 6th, and there are a number of them. This week, Dave, we had some opposition really develop against measure number one, the openness in government, the ethics measure.
Yeah, and you look at what you could probably consider to be strange bedfellows if you look at it. When you have the Chamber of Commerce or the Greater North Dakota Chamber and the ACLU both opposing measure number one, that was a very interesting twist of the story. And there are a lot of groups that are lining up behind both groups to oppose it. But, you know, it's really hard to say because – we were just talking about this earlier about not believing too much in polls because the polls that we see are, you know, slanted one way or the other. But I haven't seen any kind of legit polling about what people think about the measure itself. And it does say, you know, ethics is a good title. And, yeah, there are probably some arguments to be made that there may need to be a tightening of ethical standards, but the groups that we've talked about, the Chamber and the ACLU, think it goes too far.
Well, I think another concern is that this is an amendment to the Constitution as opposed to a statutory adjustment. So if this decision is made, it's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard supporters of Measure 1 talk about, you know, they went constitutional, I think, on purpose because of what happened in South Dakota where they had a similar measure pass but was, you know, I think basically repealed, right?
It was repealed right away from the next session, yes.
Because they wrote it into law, and it was just easier for them to do that. So if you write it into the Constitution, the thinking goes is it becomes a lot harder for you to just repeal it.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, the fact that it is a constitutional amendment on a measure that has been initiated for referendum, for popular vote, is because there are a lot of people in the state, and enough of them got organized, that were upset with the legislature's, kicking this can down the road for many years.
I think it's been kind of interesting, too, though, that there seems to be some out-of-state component to this. I got an email yesterday from someone in Washington, D.C., offering to answer questions about Measure 1 and how it will increase transparency of spending in state elections, to quote the email, which seems a bit curious to me that it's coming out of Washington, D.C. from this different group called Campaign Legal Center.
It'd be kind of fun to just research all of these fancy names for PACs.
Yeah. So I asked him about that because I said, this is a state issue. This is coming from Washington, D.C. He said they're just working to help state advocates answer questions.
Well, that's Renee Jean. She is an assistant managing editor for the Williston Herald. Also today on our panel of experts for the Editor's Roundtable, John Hageman with Forum News Service. He covers politics in Bismarck. And Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director. We'll have more of our Editor's Roundtable in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Matt O'Lean. This midterm election is one of the most closely watched in North Dakota history with local, regional, and national implications. None more so than the race for U.S. Senate, which could help maintain a Republican majority or tip the scales in favor of Democrats. Join me and the PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff Friday, October 5th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain on TV, radio, and online for a one-hour debate in the race for U.S. Senate with the candidates, the incumbent Democrat Heidi Heitkamp and U.S. Representative Republican Kevin Cramer. That's Friday, October 5th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public's TV, radio, and online streams and apps. I hope you'll join us.
Prairie Public 2018 debates are made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we have Dave Thompson, John Hageman, and Renee Jean as part of our Editor's Roundtable. We do this once a month. And colleagues, let me take you to another headline that I find in the Prairie Public newsroom and across the state in newspapers. Dakotans for Health oppose Texas versus U.S. This is that lawsuit in Texas to overturn the Affordable Care Act. The state of North Dakota is one of the interested parties in that lawsuit. And this has become a political hot potato as well.
It has, and there is a group of physicians who have gone and asked that North Dakota be kicked off the lawsuit, basically. I'm putting it in very simple terms. But, yeah, there seems to be some counter legal issues or legal maneuvering going on, too. It's just – but really North Dakota has been – or the Republican Party in North Dakota has been pretty much opposed to the Affordable Care Act. So it really was no surprise that they joined in the Texas lawsuit. But it really has become a political issue right now.
And I'm wondering again, you know, how this plays all across the state, because the Affordable Care Act has been law for a few years now. It has been attacked over and over again by partisan interests in basically getting rid of it, I assume, to return to the status quo because there's no alternative at this point. So how big an issue is this during this election cycle? We've got all this stuff going on in Washington. We've got, a big Senate race in North Dakota. How important is health care?
Well, Democrats on the campaign trail, especially Heidi Heitkamp, have tried to make it a huge issue. Campaign ads that we've seen, although they are careful not to frame it in terms of the Affordable Care Act, they talk about protections for pre-existing conditions is what, polling pretty broadly just shows that that's, a popular part of the law. So they're making the case that, we're basically the party to defend that part of the law, and Republicans have tried to, dismantle the Affordable Care Act, multiple times. Republicans have been on the defensive about this too. But it's an issue that, the Democrats are trying to hit on, pretty repeatedly.
Well, it's a bottom line issue. I mean, Dave and I are certainly old enough to remember when the health care deduction from your paycheck was a pittance compared to what it is now. This is serious money, and this is what this is part of everybody's, annual revenue and outflow stream, if you will. Who's likely to get more traction here? Kevin Cramer, as a congressman, had some very contentious town hall meetings over this issue, but he's clearly on the side that wants to overturn the Affordable Care Act. Heidi Heitkamp is one of those people who's carefully saying, I guess, well, we can – let's fix what we have. Whose argument is moving anybody?
I guess stay tuned for November 6th.
Because I
don't know how that argument plays out there. I mean, there must be polling that is motivating the candidates one way or another. I doubt that if you walked up to somebody on the street and said, what do you think of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? I doubt in North Dakota that they would say they have a favorable view of it. I mean, in most cases, unless you start talking about the individual provisions of it. Some people it's, gotten them – I mean, a lot of people it's gotten them health care, et cetera, but it's kind of politically talking about, quote-unquote, Obamacare seems to be you know, I guess you don't do that in North Dakota.
Right.
Well, I was intrigued by the fact that former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan was very prominent in the past week, going around the state advocating for the Affordable Care Act and decrying the fact that the state was involved in this Texas lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. And I've talked to Earl Pomeroy before, and he's been kind of in the mix on these. No, I think he came back to the state a couple months ago to make a similar argument about the lawsuit. And, you know, he basically blames his loss in 2010 on his vote in favor of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
That's what sunk his political career. But he says he doesn't regret it, I guess, is what he says. So,
well, the conundrum here is that the Affordable Care Act has a number of provisions that everybody likes. One is the coverage of pre-existing conditions. Right. Another would be covering, you know, the kids up until they're, 25 or 26. And
right.
So there are elements of it that if it's overturned, they're gone.
Mm-hmm. And to the Republican parts, I was at a press conference maybe a month ago. Yeah, I think it was a month ago. Where it was, you know, led by Kevin Cramer, and they had some other Republicans there. Insurance Commissioner John Godfrey was there, and they had, you know, a few guys come up there to talk, you know, about their stories about Obamacare, and they said that, you know, their premiums had gone up in X amount, a very high amount, that they basically made it healthcare unaffordable for them. So that's, you know, the Republican counters that the Affordable Care Act has not made it more affordable for some people.
That argument is out there, and I think what they're often referring to are these previous to the Affordable Care Act, there were insurance products out there that had very low premiums because they offered very little coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the argument seems to be, let's bring that back.
Yeah, I guess I don't know all the specifics. I'm not an insurance expert.
No, none of us are. Mm-hmm. But we are certainly keyed to it because it is, again, such an important part of our revenue streams these days.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to the medical marijuana dispensaries that have been approved for Bismarck and Fargo. Dave, I think a couple of years ago, the guesstimate was that there would be medical marijuana being dispensed by the fall of this year. That's looking quite unlikely.
Yeah, it looks more like the end of the year or maybe early next year. The dispensaries, the two locations, I don't know where Fargo is, but we do now have a location where the Bismarck one is going to be. It's going to be on Memorial Highway. Once the grow centers get going and they get coordinated with these two dispensaries, then they can start dispensing medical marijuana. And the health department says, well, there are two dispensaries, there are going to be more, but from these two, they can deliver them, they can deliver the product to patients outside of Bismarck and outside of Fargo. And then that could be a stopgap measure until the dispensary that's going to be closer will get in place. And there has to be some kind of mechanism to do that, and that I guess that's called for in the rules. Whether it's going to be somebody, you know, a provider, licensed provider comes down and picks it up and delivers it to the patient, or somehow the dispensary sends it by courier or some way, by car, by truck or something like that. There's a few things to work out yet. I think we're still several months away from seeing the full implementation of medical marijuana. I'm thinking maybe spring?
Yeah, well, that seems more realistic because an important line in your story on Tuesday was that Jason Wall, the marijuana division director for the state, said the timing will also depend on the two manufacturing centers getting up and running. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of loose ends here.
And last, I'll just say, the last I checked, I know the Bismarck manufacturing facility, I think they actually are registered now.
They are.
But the Fargo one is still working on getting its registration.
Yeah, but the last time I checked on any kind of seed is it takes a while to grow.
Right.
We have our editor's roundtable underway. It's near the end of September, and we'll be back with Dave Thompson, John Hageman, and Renee Jean in just a moment. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Board of Higher Education member Greg Steeman has resigned, effective immediately. Steeman resigned after Thursday's board meeting in Valley City. Steeman says he can no longer devote the time needed to serve on the board.
And I'm so appreciative and respectful of my fellow board members who are so committed and able to do that. And I've done my best to do that. And up until this point, I believed I could. And once a few of these things got completed, like we were able to hire a new president at Valley City State and close the door on some other things, I just thought it was probably the right time to step back and reprioritize my time and my efforts.
Steeman's term is up in June. He was eligible for reappointment to the board. It appears a conference committee working on a compromise new farm bill will not beat Sunday's deadline. North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp is a member of the conference committee. She says if there is no deal by Sunday, the committee can continue negotiating. She says it does not mean the sky is falling.
Because we aren't doing a major reform to the 14 bill. With some of the stuff that we've put into the 18 bill, that's all going to be for next growth season. So a lot of the reforms that we put in this bill, they aren't going to apply to the crops that are being basically harvested now.
Earlier this week, Minnesota Democratic Congressman Colin Peterson said progress toward an agreement is taking shape. He added, "We are going to get this right." And a small group of protesters gathered outside the federal building in downtown Fargo today to oppose Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. Hillary Kay was one of them.
I am wearing a Handmaid's costume, and that's kind of a stealth declaration, because unless you are inclined, I think, to progressive concerns, you're not likely to recognize it.
Kay says this wasn't her first time to a protest with her costume.
So this is, I guess, my third outing in the costume.
Okay.
And the other two times, there have been just spontaneously other women. Not people I knew in advance. They just spontaneously appear. We are summoned.
Kay says she was frustrated at Kavanaugh's unwillingness to answer questions about an FBI investigation into his alleged sexual assault of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, as well as his aggressive and partisan demeanor during yesterday's hearing. She says the protesters know Senator Heidi Heitkamp is not in town today, but they still want her to understand how strongly they feel about Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. She says Heitkamp's vote in the proceedings is critical because it is a swing vote.
Senators serve for 6-year terms. Kavanaugh may be on the bench for decades. This is going to be part of her legacy. And what does she want her name to be in our children's mouths?
Kay says she hopes people will acknowledge the significance of Supreme Court decisions on everyone's lives, and if they haven't already, contact their representatives to let them know how they feel. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. It is our editor's roundtable. We have our news director, Dave Thompson, and John Hageman with the Forum News Service in Bismarck. And Renee Jean joins us by phone from Williston. She's the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. Renee, you propose that we chat a bit about some energy-related issues in your region of the state. And one in particular that you've been working on has to do with the ordinary high water mark of Lake Sakakawea, because there are some mineral rights at stake there.
Right. The state has released that study. Mineral rights are going to be returning to 26,000 landowners or so. It's quite a case. But at the same time, the new study is going to take 10,000 acres of new mineral rights and throw them into question. So I was just talking with the attorney who had been representing the Wilkinson family in this disputed case, and he said he's already talking to those affected landowners, and he's expecting that it will be a new lawsuit soon to come.
So these 26,000 people and these 10,000 this is a fair amount of money. These are royalties at stake here?
Did I say people? 26,000 acres.
Okay, acres. So, this is a fair amount of acreage that would involve mineral rights. Yeah.
Right. And even at 10,000, it's still quite an extensive amount for some, could be quite extensive for some people. Of course, Williams County, there are landowners here in Williams County that are affected by that, with Lake Sakakawea being kind of running through this area.
So that I understand it, though, is that literally the issue is where that high water mark delineates perhaps whether or not your land, you qualify for mineral rights or the state qualifies for mineral rights?
Well, in the 50s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did a survey of all the land that it was taking. So the Corps did that survey, and, you know, for decades, that's kind of been the gold standard for all the land men. That's what they referred to figure out who owns what mineral rights. So then the state did a study, the West and Bartlett study, and said, oh, wait a minute, you know, a bunch of these mineral rights are flooded. They're underwater. They should belong to the state. And so landowners like Edward Lynch here in Williams County got a letter suddenly reducing the number of mineral acres that they owned with no explanation, even though they had decades of records showing that they indeed owned the mineral rights. So that led to the court case. And, of course, the Supreme Court said, or ruled, you know, that if you're going to take these minerals, you have to compensate for them.
Well, so, it seems another complication here is that this is a reservoir lake, and the level is adjustable.
Well, and so that's why the legislature wanted to find out what the ordinary high water mark was in the 50s, and I guess used that.
Okay. Before it was impounded. Okay.
right.
So this is an ongoing legal dispute over who owns the mineral rights, and they might be rather valuable.
It also depends on what kind of legal channels they use.
Channels.
Yeah. Okay, very well done. Sorry, Dave. The punster struck. You had one more issue, Renee, that you wanted to get on the table here, and that is this proposed Roosevelt gas plant expansion and the perhaps lack of candor on the part of the company.
Well, and, you know, it's fair to say, too, that the company can file late exhibits that may explain the discrepancy. But so the company had testified that they had talked to the neighbors and didn't know of any objections, and the neighbors were there, and they testified that no one from the company had come to speak to them. And so that led to, at the end of the hearing, public service commissioners were admonished the company about their, they want them to be more proactive in the future about talking to the neighbors of their projects and making sure that the individuals can connect that face with the company and that they have the appropriate contact information to address concerns. Julie Fedorchak said, you know, that many of the concerns the two neighbors had raised were actually things that could have been addressed. So she said she was particularly frustrated that, you know, these kind of things keep coming up.
Well, in the story that you published in the Williston Herald, those neighbors were talking about some pretty significant disruptions to ordinary life while they were recognizing that they were living in an industrial zone.
Right. And originally, of course, they purchased that property because it was in the country. I think Mr. Denton, that 110 acres that he owns, he bought it for wildlife, to encourage wildlife. And so now suddenly the wildlife is living with gas plants.
Okay. So the Roosevelt gas plant expansion is somewhat controversial in your part of the state, and apparently the PSC has been looking at it and is looking for some resolution there. Dave, you were all over the State Board of Higher Education meeting today. You filed story after story after story, and we may as well pick one just to kind of relate to what we were talking about before we went to the news break, and that is the Board of Higher Education cannot and will not, in your headline, take a formal position on recreational marijuana.
And this is where the facts and some of the feelings got a little bit fuzzy at one point, because when it was brought up in the governance committee, there were apparently the story that was told was that some state officials had asked the board to take a position. Well, their attorney did some work, and the board, being a state agency, cannot take a formal position. However, individual board members can take a position, which led to a couple of interesting motions. it's a little esoteric, but I'll just tell you how the discussion went and why this is really still very up in the air on a lot of things. It was presented to the board, but two members of the board were out working with the new contract for the Valley City State President. And so there was a vote to table that motion. The vote passed on a 4-2 vote. However, there were two votes absent, but they were within the building. The chairman said, yeah, the issue is tabled. But then when the people got back, they brought it back, and they brought it back, and it was a 4-4 vote to table. And that was just discussing the issue. So they had a presentation about what the effects could be on the university system. But, again, they cannot take a position on that.
Okay.
It was an interesting meeting.
Well, and you mentioned that Dr. Alan Lefebvre has now been hired as the Valley City State University president.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tisa Mason went on to Fort Hays,
that's right.
Kansas.
She went home. That's her home country.
Yeah, she's the president of the university there. She was 3 years at VCSU. So there is a new leader at mm-hmm. Valley City. And then you also filed a story about higher ed board members a bit concerned about this idea for a tiered committee system to look at various aspects of higher ed.
Now, and I think John can weigh in on this too because he listened to some of the discussion at the governor's task force today. But really, there had been talk about having three separate boards to control the universities, one separate board for the two-year colleges, one for the four-year colleges, one for the research universities. And one thing that the chancellor was looking at was maybe having a committee structure instead under the Board of Higher Education, where you'd have one for the two-year schools, one for the four-year schools, and one for the research universities. Well, that's just been a discussion. And some of the board members say, hey, wait a second. We're one board. These are all our universities under our control. And putting it into committees, well, that's an awful lot of work, and maybe the whole board should look at it. So that discussion is not over. I think you'll see it brought back. And then there was some discussion at the task force today about it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, not any resolution today on this whole discussion on the task force, which, you know, the governor created by executive order almost a year ago, some like 10 months ago, I guess. He wanted to look at, you know, can we organize higher education governance differently? They have about, you know, a handful of options that they're looking at. It seems like they're putting their energy towards, you know, some kind of multi-board model. I don't think necessarily ruling out having a single board like they do now, but it seems like they're maybe leaning towards multiple boards. And that would be, I guess, a major change to.
And it would take a constitutional change because the Board of Higher Education is in the Constitution.
Right.
Whereas if you went to subcommittees, it wouldn't necessarily take a constitutional change.
Right. And voters just a few years ago, if you remember, rejected easily this change to, you know, the Higher Education Board. The measure was, you know, to create a commission basically of a full-time commission instead of a higher education board, and voters rejected that. So I don't know what the, I guess, appetite is to change the higher education model.
Well,
voters.
Higher education has been a whipping boy for the legislature for a long time, so I suppose they can just chat about it and at least look like they're doing something. Just me throwing my two cents in there. Dave, you had a story earlier this week, and I wonder if Renee has some insight on this as well. Representative Bill Oliver from Newtown is resigning effective the end of October. He says his life situation has changed. What's going on?
Well, I was not able to get into it directly because I didn't have a chance to talk to him. I'm still waiting for a call back, but I understand he may be leaving North Dakota, and I think that's why the vacancy occurred.
I see.
So what happens is that because the seat is in Republican hands, the Republican executive committee will get together and the chairman and the committee will pick somebody to replace him, and he will serve until the 2020 election when Oliver was up. If that does not happen, and the odd thing about North Dakota law is if they don't get it done, they have a 20-day after the chairman receives a letter from legislative management. And if they don't do it in 20 days, then the chairman of legislative management has to make the appointment.
Wow. I think that's a pretty impressive bit of authority there.
It is. But the chairman of legislative management, who I have talked to, said he doesn't want to do that. He wants to leave that in the hands of the local committee.
Okay. So there isn't any way that this would be on the ballot in November, I take it?
There's no way. I mean, yeah. with the ballots already being printed.
Sure.
Right.
Early voting has started, I guess, in some places. If you can absentee ballot.
Right.
So too late for this election. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, we have run out of time for our editor's roundtable as well. So it goes quickly. It only happens once a month. And my thanks to Dave Thompson, our news director, as a pleasure to always have you on our air, Dave.
Thank you.
John Hageman with you, and Bismarck, he's a political reporter for the Forum News Service. Thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Renee Jean, thanks for joining us by phone from Williston, assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Okay. Coming up on Main Street, Matt Olien reviews A Simple Favor.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that fanfare says it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And Matt, you went to A Simple Favor, kind of a complicated comedy caper, isn't it?
It's a complicated film because it's alternately a Hitchcockian thriller, a kind of suburban single-parent comedy. And when the two meet, unbelievably, director Paul Feig, who's best known for the director of Bridesmaids, manages to keep the tone remarkably cohesive. Sometimes when films don't know what they are, Doug, the moods can change rapidly and you're almost like you're in a different movie. But I liked it. I would say 75% of this works. There are a lot of twists and turns. Let me just briefly explain the plot. So Anna Kendrick plays a single mom near Connecticut, and she has a mommy vlog where she talks to mommies about that's what she calls it. Recipes and tips on parenting and whatnot, and she's the doer at school. She's always organizing things for the class, the first grade class of her son. And everything changes when her son starts to befriend a little boy named Nikki, whose mom is Emily, and that is played by Blake Lively. And Blake Lively is very chic. She's well-dressed all the time. She's glamorous. And the boys have play dates, and so Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively start hanging around. They're very different people. Anna Kendrick is very very perky and very seemingly naive and innocent, and Blake Lively swears a lot, drinks martinis, is married to a famous author or once famous author played by Henry Golding, who was recently seen in Crazy Rich Asians. The movie really changes when she Anna Kendrick is always doing things for people. I can pick your son up at school if you're delayed. She starts to take advantage of her. She starts picking up the son occasionally until one time when she picks him up, Blake Lively doesn't show up to get her son later in the day. And days go by and days go by and days go by and she's missing. And then the film becomes basically a Hitchcockian thriller. What's going on? Where is she? What is she up to? What does the husband know? And what is Anna Kendrick going to do about all this, if anything? That's when the film really becomes a different film, kind of like Vertigo territory, Le Diabolique, the 1954 French thriller. That's really the territory we're in. Like I said, the film is very funny at times. Kendrick's comic timing is very good. She's been described as the Ryan Reynolds of actresses. In fact, Blake Lively referred to her that way. She's very good in the film. But some people don't respond to Anna Kendrick's kind of unique chemistry on screen. Some don't care for it. Some do. That'll depend on if you like the film. Lively is very good. As always, I really like her as an actress. She really comes off like a bona fide movie star. And so, you know, the twists and turns get goofy. They get crazy, Doug. It might be too much for people. Some criticism has been that Kendrick's character arc is completely unbelievable in this film. where she starts the film to where she ends. And that's all I'm going to say about that. That has been a major criticism of the film. But I think overall it works about 75% of the time, and I liked it better than I thought I would.
Okay, but this description, as you mentioned, is complicated
because
you go up to IMDb and it says comedy, crime, drama.
It's everything, Doug. It is alternately funny. Tragedy is never far away, but it's also kind of kept at arm's length at times. So Paul Feig really walks that tightrope, and it is a tightrope in filmmaking. Filmmaking is like a jigsaw puzzle, Doug. It is putting pieces of a story with music and editing and which shot you go to, and it's very delicate to do. People that have edited narrative features know how hard it is to do, and sometimes the tone gets wildly off. I think this one sustained the tone pretty well. The dialogue is snappy. Lively and Kendrick have great scenes together. You can tell they had a lot of chemistry on screen. Henry Golding as the husband is kind of a background character. He's more window dressing. We're not really sure what he's up to, what he knows. Are he and Blake Lively really in love? Is this a marriage of convenience? What is this? And what does he know about her disappearance? So it's a fascinating film, and I actually liked it, like I said, quite a bit better than I thought I was going to. The reviews have been pretty good on this so far.
Now, does this make some sort of social commentary? Is there a message here, or is it just...
No, I didn't sense that, Doug. It's based on a novel. We're kind of back to Gone Girl territory, if you remember that film, although not quite as serious as Gone Girl was. There's, like I said, there's elements of slapstick and comedy in this as well, but I didn't sense that as much as just a wild, twisting and turning disappearance thriller.
Okay, so how's it doing in the box office?
It's doing fairly well, but right now, again, is kind of that time when a lot of films aren't doing real well, and we're waiting for, you know, in a couple weeks, we've got A Star Is Born and First Man. That's when the Oscar season really kicks off, October 5th.
Well, recently, I was flying above the earth, and I was watching a lot of movies, and I know you want to talk about a new project by Jane Fonda, because I saw her in a movie, The Book Club, and I was reminded how good an actress she is and these other people who were in the movie with her.
So there's an HBO documentary out called Jane Fonda in Five Acts. I watched it the other night, couldn't take my eyes off it. It's about 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's an easy sit. It covers her life, her career. The five acts really, Doug, refer to the men in her life. Act one is her father, Henry. And then we have 2, 3, and 4, her three husbands, Roger Vadim, Tom Hayden, and Ted Turner. And finally, act five, it just says Jane. So it really follows her career, her relationships with men, her difficult relationship with her father, a very emotionally vacant man when he didn't have a script in front of him. But of course, we know she kind of resolved that with him making On Golden Pond, and that's good. And I don't sense any bitterness from her either. I like that part of this where, you know, every man in her life contributed something to her life, even though they weren't completely fully realized relationships. The Vietnam stuff is fascinating, Doug. You know what I'm driving at here.
I do.
A lot of people detest Jane Fonda for her trip to North Vietnam. When you watch the video now of her with the helmet on, sitting behind the gun, meeting with POWs, American POWs, where she was assured they were not being tortured and they were fine, you kind of have what Dick Cavett says in the documentary is, what was she thinking? And I don't know that she was thinking at the time. It was a very naive thing to do. However, she's apologized many times for that. And whether people accept that or not, I guess, is up to them. But when you watch the video, it's fascinating to go back to that time, Doug, that you're older than me and you know what I'm driving at here. Was she a traitor? What was she doing over in North Vietnam? And it's fascinating to watch this section to really understand how different those times were and what she did. And, you know, it's whether you forgive her or not, I guess, depends on if you want to move goalposts or forgive people or what your agenda is. That's my view of it.
It's
a fascinating life that she has led. It's not done. She's 80 years old. And I would encourage people to watch this documentary.
Well, as you were suggesting, it's a reminder of how deep the political divides were then, just as they are now occasionally.
Yeah.
So this is what I'll look for. I want to see A Simple Favor. I want to see the movie, and I want to see the Jane Fonda in 5X on HBO. That's a pretty interesting opportunity. Okay, here's a little Oscar trivia. And this one is probably woefully too easy for you, but there have only been two people in history who have won a Nobel Prize for Literature and an Oscar. Only one of them won a Nobel Prize for Literature and an Oscar for a screenplay.
I think it's George Bernard Shaw.
And you are right.
For Pygmalion?
That is correct.
Okay.
And the other one, just for the current events, you know, it's not that long ago, who got the other one?
Nobel Prize for Literature and an Oscar. Not
and also a Grammy.
And also a Grammy.
It's the only triple threat guy ever.
Bob Dylan.
There you go. Hibbing Boy. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 28th. The legacy of an accomplished North Dakota artist can still be seen in the Burleigh County Courthouse in Bismarck. Clell Gannon painted a number of murals in the courthouse vestibule depicting scenes from North Dakota history, such as Verendery meets the Mandans and the Sibley Campaign. The courthouse is in Art Deco style, built during the same period as the state capitol skyscraper. Gannon was born in 1900 in Nebraska, but by age 8, his family had settled on a farm near Underwood in North Dakota. After graduating from high school, he studied at the Art Institute of Chicago for 2 years until an illness intervened. He returned to North Dakota and came to work as a secretary for the superintendent of the Soo Line Railway. He later became an artist for Provident Life Insurance in Bismarck. Gannon's inspiration for his murals came from the landscape, history, scenery, and wildlife of the Great Plains. He also wrote poetry and published 2 collections, with a third published by his family after his death. It was on this date in 1962 that the Bismarck Tribune reported on Gannon's death the night before. He was 62. His obituary described him as one of North Dakota's leading artists and one of the most beloved figures in the state. Gannon associated with others who shared his interest in history. In 1926, he canoed the Little Missouri River with George Will and Russell Reed, men who would each take a turn as director of the State Historical Society. The trio traveled from Marmouth, North Dakota, to the Missouri River, then on to Bismarck. This was before the Garrison Dam created Lake Sakakawea. Their efforts in documenting and recording North Dakota history remain in the books, photos, and artwork they left behind. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Saturday on Weekend Edition, the fallout from this week's Supreme Court hearings, political in the White House and Capitol and personal, and memories and relationships across the country. That and updates on the Mueller investigation and renewed support for the Equal Rights Amendment, and all the latest news, Weekend Edition, Saturday from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we will continue our candidate visits with Kelly Armstrong, the Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. And during her visit to HostFest, Ashley Thornburg learned about Viking warrior women from Kelsey Patton. Kelsey's an instructor at the Viking Village Camp, so we'll hear about that on Monday. And we hope you can check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.